And after a healthy and nourishing lunch, no one will feel like they need a nap because we have a lot of more stuff to do. This afternoon, we're going to begin with a series of panels looking at the Brain Society diagnostic from separate points of view. Our next panel is looking at it from a societal point of view and the idea of bridging disciplinary modeling. Our panelists include Nancy Ross, Associate Professor, Department of Geography, McGill University, Prakash Shetty, Professor, Institute of Human Nutrition, University of Southampton Medical School in the UK. And is Joseph here?
No, he's not.
Okay, all right. And Jean-Pierre Dubé, who's the Sigmund E. Edelstone Professor of Marketing and Robert King Steele Faculty Fellow at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. We'll begin with Nancy.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lorette, thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you all this afternoon. Definitely my talk is at the societal level here. I wasn't able to be here this morning to hear what you discussed this morning, but certainly this is on the societal end and not the brain end of the discussions. I think that is really a relevant and important scale at which to look at obesity. What I want to do, I'm going to talk a little bit about the rise of obesity in Canada, and then I'm going to ask a fairly provocative question about whether or not obesity is actually truly a risk factor for premature mortality. I'll show some of the work I've done with colleagues at Statistics Canada, looking at over 12 years of follow-up on 11,000 Canadians. And the answer, really, I'll just steal my own thunder here, is that overweight does not seem to be a significant risk for mortality for Canadians. If anything, it's protective. And we don't really get to see serious risk until we get into the obese class 2 and 3, where there's a demonstrable risk for premature mortality. So I'll talk about that provocative finding in a moment. I'm going to look at a little bit about the predictions for the future. It's really not very pretty if we project forward to what Canadian obesity is going to look like in the next 20 years or so. And the predictions for men are particularly bad, and we'll show you that in a moment. Then I'm going to bring it back a little bit to some of the work on obesity and urban sprawl that I worked on with some colleagues, demonstrating for the first time in the Canadian context that if you happen to live in a sprawling urban environment, there's an incremental influence on your risk for being overweight and for being obese. And I'll bring it back down to the ground, still with this theme of environment obesity, and talk a little bit about our work on walking and diabetes control in a Montreal cohort, which starts from the perspective that if you can get individuals who are already diagnosed with type 2 diabetes to be more physically active, you can actually control their diabetes very well, almost as well as a pharmacological intervention. It's just, you know, what kind of neighborhoods are those patients living in, and does the neighborhood that they live in promote or not promote being physically active? And I'll try to tie everything together for you at the end. So obesity in Canada has increased over the last 30 years or so. It's projected to increase even more, from about 48% to about 57% of men. So an average male in Canada is now overweight or obese. And same, women are not, the rate is not that high for women, but the direction is the same. And we ask ourselves, is this a normal response to somehow an abnormal environment? And just as a pause, I want to sort of temper our discussions here today and tomorrow with our work that has looked at whether or not overweight and obesity are truly put Canadians at risk for premature mortality. We know there's fairly good literature and established links to type 2 diabetes, obesity being a very strong risk factor for that, chronic disease, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, stroke, gallbladder disease, some forms of cancer, and so on. But the evidence around the risk of obesity and overweight for premature mortality is actually quite mixed, both in Canada and the United States. In our work, this is purposely really small, so not bog you down on the details, and I'll bring you through it. What we did is we looked at the National Population Health Survey and followed individuals for, about 12 years of follow-up on individuals, 11,000 Canadians, and looked at who died and looked at the risk of premature mortality in the group. And the usual suspects come out. If you're older, you're more at risk of death. And, you know, over 75, for example, your relative risk of death relative to a young person is very, very high. Smokers, for example, if you're a daily smoker relative to a non-smoker, your risk of premature mortality is very high. Physically inactive, again, not as high as smoking, but, again, puts you at risk of premature mortality. The alcohol story is a good story for those of you who like the occasional drink. So the lowest risk for mortality is actually people who drink a little bit on a daily basis. But if you look at the BMI levels, I'll walk you through this a little bit, but the risk of premature mortality is actually elevated in the underweight. It's actually lowest in the overweight, and it doesn't increase again until you get into the morbidly obese category. So the curve looks something like this. It's that sort of U-shaped curve or J-shaped curve that you see for alcohol. It's fairly similar in the Canadian context for overweight and obesity. So the lowest risk, if you look at the BMI levels, and remember that BMI is in the category 25 to 30 would be an overweight individual, at least by the WHO categories. So 20 to 24 is what we're really told to aim for in achieving ideal BMI. But that does not translate, at least empirically in the Canadian context, nor in the American context, into lowest risk for mortality. So maybe we've just got the categories wrong, but it makes us wonder about how we can interpret that finding. So it's consistent from the American work. We looked at self-reported BMI. That's all we have in these data. But when we were able to look at surveys that compared people's self-reports of body mass index to their measured body mass index, we were able to just help the systematic patterns of lying in the data. So in other words, women tend to underreport their weight. Men tend to overreport their heights systematically. And so we're able to, interesting, eh? And so we're able to correct for that. And when we did that correction, we were able to adjust and make sure that it's really not the self-reported nature of BMI that's driving the relationship. We also took out the dying. You know, we did the analysis by taking those wasters away. If you died in the first 2 years after our analysis, we actually took those deaths out because people could have been in the wasting process or dying, and didn't want to look at that. So we tried to slice and dice the data in a number of ways to ensure we weren't seeing something that wasn't there. We also asked the question, we didn't answer this, but is it the case that pharmacological initiatives in Canada and the public health system, you know, whether it's expensive, yes, but maybe some of those pharmacological approaches to reducing cardiovascular risk actually dampen the effect of obesity and overweight on mortality. But we also asked ourselves at the end, do the WHO categories even make sense? Are we telling people the right things? Okay, so that's just to temper the discussion. I want to talk a little bit about the future, and I want to talk a little bit more about this notion of, you know, environment as being somewhat behind our obesity situation. So this is work by Christelle Lepetit and Jean-Marie Berthelot at Statistics Canada, who were able to project forward obesity rates. So what you're seeing there is different age groups and the future on that axis that goes this way. As you can see, as women age, if their likelihood of obesity increases, and this aging over time is looking like to be responsible for some of that growth in obesity. If we look at a regional effect, this is quite interesting. This is the geography of obesity right here. And if you look across the Canadian provinces and do those projections forward, Atlantic Canada, for example, is expected to have much more of an obesity burden than is Quebec. We call this the Céline Dion effect here in Quebec, right? So if you look, you project forward, the Quebec women appear to be relatively protected. So raising this question of this, the place-based nature of obesity, that environment seems to have a pull environment seems to get under the skin very noticeably when we start to study things like obesity. Ontario and the prairies, not as problematic as Atlantic Canada, and BC, a little bit more like Quebec. So I think it's fairly convincing environment has a play here. And then gender, right? So if we project forward for males, for example, the picture looks a lot more bleak for men than it does for women. And then we need to think about those categories again and whether or not BMI is an effective measure of male mortality risk through overweight and obesity. I think that's a very important thing to raise. So what's going on? What can we do? We don't think it's a major genetic shift in the population. The obesity rise has happened so quickly. Doubtful, right? So maybe we need to focus on the things we do every day, the environments that we're exposed to every day that could be behind some of that rise. So we can look at foodscapes. We now have an unlimited caloric landscape around us for very cheap. We also have a lifestyle that sets us up for fairly sedentary behavior. And so to ask people to swim against that stream of normal behavior, which is more sedentary, I think is a tall order for many people. The reason we focus on this is that if we think about the most successful public health interventions of our times, they've actually modified environments. They've not wagged their fingers at people, but they've said, we're going to make the environments easier for people to engage in the more healthful behaviors. If we think about smoking control, we think about public health initiatives in industrial Britain and around housing and so on, they're the ones that really had a major effect on population health. So we use this term obesogenicity, which is the sum of influence in the surrounding environment that may affect the obesity level of an individual or a population. Why do we think neighborhoods matter? Clearly, neighborhoods set up life trajectories of individuals. The availability and price of food, for example, has an influence. Recreational opportunities, even urban form like sidewalk quality, aesthetics of the neighborhood, safety, and so on. Suburban development that takes people far and further away potentially from their places of work, and then has no utilitarian walking. All of these little sort of things add up to create a more sedentary existence. We even look systematically at this across Montreal and looked at while the presence of parks is fairly equitably distributed in a city like Montreal, which is actually a fairly equitable city, the existence of decay and graffiti and sort of unwelcomeness around park quality in lower income neighborhoods is readily apparent, even in a city like Montreal. The social nature of the obesity epidemic is probably also best captured by these curves. People who study epidemiology, this looks a lot like Jeffrey Rose's work when he studied the blood pressure of Kenyan nomads and compared it to the blood pressure of British civil servants. We could think of the same way here of the obesity patterns of low-income women, or this is actually poorly educated women, compared to women with the most education. So that red distribution line is women who didn't graduate from high school. The light blue line is women with a high school education, and that navy blue distribution is women with a post-secondary degree. And so, you know, these curves are remarkably different. And note the red curve, which, you know, the mean of the red curve is higher with the frequency of the highest frequency closer and closer to that overweight range, and certainly higher levels in the obese range. So, you know, we have a spatial pattern to obesity that's very prominent, it's very gendered, and it's also varies remarkably by social class. So any efforts to tackle that has to take all of that into consideration. So some specific empirical work focusing on the relationship between environment and obesity looks at the relationship here in Canada between obesity and urban sprawl. Does living in a sprawling urban environment bestow upon you extra risk in addition to your individual characteristics for becoming obese, for being obese? This is the kind of neighborhoods we're talking about, tend to be further from the center of the city, tend to have residential buildings, but not a lot of potential for walking to walking for utilitarian purposes, walking to grocery store, walking to anything other than a residential home. So this is the sort of quick and dirty look. That's when we do our fancy modeling, those first scatter plots always ring true in the end in some ways. So this is just a very crude scatter plot looking at a measure of urban sprawl and mean body mass index of urban Canadians. And so there's this positive relationship. So the more sprawling the city, the heavier the population. And we do our fancy modeling and say, let's tease out those individual attributes, how old you are, where you live, what kind of neighborhood you live in, what's your social background, how much fruit and vegetables do you eat on a daily basis, how much physical activity do you do. Lo and behold, that blue line remains important for men. In other words, for men, there's an incrementally important influence of the environment on their body mass index. For women, that relationship disappears. We should ask ourselves here in these kinds of meetings what a new way of looking at the city, a new organization of the city may offer. Varied land use options, access to public transit has a myriad of benefits. It just takes a lot of collective resources to try to get that put into place. So I'm just going to end on this, the view from here. So translating some of this environment and obesity research from the big national scale, 35,000 feet view, to looking what we can do at the local scale to try to understand better how people, how the environment impinges on people's behavior. So we've asked the question, does neighborhood environment influence the walking behavior of diabetes patients? And what we were able to do is look at a cohort of diabetes patients who've reported their steps per day based on pedometers and try to trace back their other characteristics and include their environmental characteristics. So we created what is known as a geographic information system to create a walkability index of these neighborhoods. And we're able to characterize neighborhoods as being more or less walkable in the city of Montreal. So those downtown neighborhoods tend to provide much more walkability than some of the further out suburban neighborhoods. And, you know, not surprisingly, the more affluent neighborhoods are also the more walkable neighborhoods. Again, place, social conditions coming together to influence the environments to which people are exposed. So we also did environmental auditing, which actually matches up quite well with our GIS index. And we looked at things like land use mix, sidewalk quality, safety, presence of garbage, leafy green, a number of different things to be able to characterize neighborhoods as being walkable or not walkable. So I'll end up trying to pull all this together. I think it's fairly convincing now that we need to change our daily environments if we're going to affect obesity on a large scale at a population level. Obesity is on the rise. The future doesn't look very good. It looks particularly bad for men. It's unlikely a genetic shift. I think this is we need to consider the role of obesogenic environments. We should also temper our understanding of this as the weight of the public health issue here, recognizing that we couldn't see a link between overweight and premature mortality. Even when we look at things like quality of life as an outcome and chronic disease, we don't see a lot of evidence as overweight being particularly problematic. We do see evidence of obese class 1 and 2 and 3 as being particularly problematic for both quality of life, chronic disease, and mortality. So we should keep that in mind. Obesity is linked to urban sprawl for Canadian men, so the men with long car-dependent commutes are at risk. I'll just end saying that we can do a lot of local-scale work as well. It requires more labor. We could also start to use things like Google Street View and so on to do some of the labor for us, so we can think of some innovative ways and tools now that local mapping has become so detailed and so visual. So there's lots of room for doing this kind of work that's local on a much, much larger scale. And in terms of our results for our diabetes cohort, we're not quite ready there yet, but we've certainly done a lot of the environmental measurement. So stay tuned for that. So I'll conclude and pass the mic. Thank you.